All right. So we are getting there. I said it again. All right. Now it's going to drive me crazy. Okay. So we're in Esther chapter 2. I will just review a little bit. If somebody wants to briefly summarize what we went over in chapter 1, that would be great. In 3 weeks ago, we got into through verse 4. But if somebody wants to summarize after that for us, kind of what happened in chapter 1.
Throws temper tantrums and doesn't get his way. He throws lots of feasts where there's lots of drinking for 6 months, and then, well, let's do another week of this. Queen Vashti throws her own, and then during that time, they want Queen Vashti to come wearing only her crown. She says, nope. Well, you're not going to be queen anymore. So.
Right. Yep. Yes, yes. He just dethroned her. We kind of talked last week. Some were saying that they thought they had heard maybe she was killed, but as far as I understand, she was not killed. Because even somebody was saying that they thought maybe later on in life she came back into the court in some manner. Right.
Oh, okay.
Her son,
yeah, I remember that now.
And some
Which,
people think maybe she was pregnant at this time,
yeah.
Which is
Right, maybe. It could be.
Yeah, we don't so mean all the time. I mean, you know.
Right, well, because he just
right.
killed people left and right.
Right.
But if she was carrying his child, she may not have.
Right, he might not
Right, he wouldn't have wanted to kill off his offspring. That would have taken on his. Artaxerxes was the, was to follow. I didn't find anything that specifically say that, but that's not, again, I didn't exhaust all efforts to find out. So it is possible. Well, that somebody was saying that they thought they had seen in an extra biblical. I didn't read that, but somebody else said that they thought that they had read that during the time of Artaxerxes, she was kind of behind the scenes. But I didn't find anything specifically. So there could be, and I thought I'd keep looking and see if I could find anything. But even we see in chapter 2, we'll see today that he remembered her many years later. I mean, 4 years passed between the end of chapter 1 and verse 2. I mean chapter 2. And so obviously she was memorable enough to him that maybe he loved her truly, you know, and maybe that was why he didn't kill her. Who knows? Who knows? But yeah, either way, he just dethroned her. He took away her position as in power. Was there any questions or anything before we get started, or anything anybody wanted to add to the beginning of that?
Well, and then Ahasuerus sends out a decree that women have to honor their husbands. Because I guess his counselors were afraid that
Right.
Vashti's example would be a bad example for
Right.
them.
Right.
Disobey their husbands.
They made a decree that was already pretty well at the time.
Right.
Right. Right, because it was an honor-based society, so it was, you were supposed to honor your husband no matter what, but now they were going to legislate it. But now.
Isn't that back in the beginning when Genesis?
Yeah,
I
right,
mean, and
yes.
then now they're just now
Yep. He's
making the law.
kind of, he's just, right, he's trying to legislate the heart, and we know that that's impossible to legislate the heart because the heart is sinful, and we do sinful things. And so it's very difficult to legislate the heart. So they just were kind of trying to, they were trying to scare the women into doing it, basically, because they're trying to make them fearful that there would be a consequence if they didn't. And there's no consequence given, but they were making Vashti an example that she, even the queen, could be taken away, her throne could be taken away. So you little meek peasants, watch out, because if you go up against your husband, just wait, you know. So we don't know what the consequence would have been or how that would have been enforced, you know, if the husbands would have been the one, I guess they would have been had to be the ones enforcing it because they would have been the only ones to know. But some consequence apparently would have happened. So yes, like we said, we've set this stage for the story of Esther that we've got this hot-headed king who thinks that he's all that in a bag of rocks. He thinks he's the King of Kings. And we know that there is only one King of Kings, and that is the Lord. So this arrogant King of Kings, he likes to, like Marian said, throws down excessive parties. And we only have such a brief meeting of Queen Vashti. I mean, we see her so briefly, but we know that that small role that she played in this story of simply, truly her only role was to say no to the king. That is such a huge piece of this story, because without her saying no, she wouldn't have been dethroned, and then we wouldn't have Queen Esther entering the stage. And so that was a huge part to this story. As we talk about God's providence in this story, that we see, we don't actually see him. We don't see him anywhere in here. As we've said, we don't see God mentioned. We don't see prayer mentioned. But yet we see in his providence, him using people who were not following him for his glory to end up saving his people from mass genocide. And so it's, I think, like I said last week, there's a part of me that I really struggle and wrestle with this idea of, can we say that in God's providence, he placed a hot-headed, angry man as king at that time to then dethrone him? You know, there's a little piece of me that I struggle in thinking, Lord, I know that you set up kings and you take down kings and they are like water in your hand. You make them go to which way you desire them. But it's hard for me in my human mind to think that that was how he chose, you know, to use them, is this horrible, horrible man, you know. But obviously God's ways are far beyond my ways, and I trust that his plan is absolutely perfect.
Well,
from the beginning.
He must have blessed Abbasi because he didn't kill her.
Sure.
Let that king kill her.
Sure. Right. Yep. He had some favor on her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep, because we know that he could have easily just said, off with you. But maybe he loved her enough to not do that, even in his drunkenness. Right. We were saying last week that we think from Jewish tradition, they say that the whole reason that King Xerxes even brought her out in the first place was he wanted to settle the disagreement of whose wife was the prettiest, and he felt his was, so they think that he brought her out, right? Yeah, that would have been a little more respectful. I think as we go through this text, it's important to think about God's providence and how he utilizes each of these things. And you know, how does that sit with you? And we have to wrestle with the tension of scripture where it says we have to pursue holiness and righteousness at all costs, but yet he allows even the evil in the world and uses it for his glory. And it's hard for me in my human mind to wrestle with that, but it's just another one of those things that we have to hold in tension with each other, knowing that God's ways are far beyond my ways, and who am I, the clay, to say to the potter that you did it wrong or that I know better. You know, that's not for me to say. His ways are far greater. And, you know, we will see as the story unfolds that he had a plan from the very beginning. None of this was by chance. It was not just circumstance that this happened. It was his plan. And so then at the same time, while that's hard, I can also take such great hope and joy in that plan, because I can then know and be confident that nothing in my life was by accident. It wasn't by chance. It was by his providence and his sovereignty in my life that he allowed certain things to happen, or he gave grace in certain areas. And all right. Let's read real quick. Let's turn to Proverbs 16:4. Proverbs 16:4. If somebody will read that for us when you get there. Oh, wait, no, I'm in the wrong one. Proverbs 16:4.
The Lord has prepared everything for his
purpose, even the wicked for the day of disaster.
So there too, I mean, he's prepared everything. Everything. We can say that everything. And I think it's easy to think the blessings that he gives or the good things that come out of it, or when we distinctly see that someone is honoring the Lord, it's so easy for us just in that moment to say, okay, that's the Lord. But truly, it's everything. It's every part of it, of the history of the world has been his plan. And so we can have great hope in that. And, you know, as if you know the end of the story, as the story goes along and we start to build this suspense of all of the Jews potentially being wiped out by Haman and his decree that's made, we could start to feel nervous, like, Lord, what are you doing? These are your people. Why would you let them? But we know that in the end, he turns that around and he saves them. So, all right, let's start in chapter 2. If somebody can read for us chapter 2, verses 1 through 14.
Now there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimeah, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it came about when the king commanded and decree of the king were heard, and the many young ladies were gathered to the citadel of Susa under the custody of Hegai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace into the custody of Hegai, who was in charge of the women. Now the young lady pleased him and found favor with him. So he quickly provided her with cosmetics and food, gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace, and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. Every day Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. Now when the turn of each young lady came to go in to King Ahasuerus, after the end of her 12 months under the regulations for the women, for the days of their beautification were completed as follows: 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and the cosmetics for women. The young lady would go into the king in this way. Anything that she desired was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem to the custody of Shaashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not again go into the king unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name.
All right, so as I was saying before, quite a bit of time has passed in between the end of chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2, sorry. So we see back in chapter 1, verse 3, it says, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. So the third year of his reign. Now, if we skip ahead in chapter 2 to verse 16, it says that it's in the seventh year. Verse 16, it says, and when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the seventh year of his reign. So, you know, about 4, maybe 3.5 years have passed between the end of verse 1. Chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2. So after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, I think I had always read it just thinking it was maybe the next day, you know, he woke up and got sober and was like, oh no, what did I do? But this was many years in between. Now, back in the beginning of chapter one, that 180-day feast where they were campaigning to overtake the Greeks, it is very likely that the battle against the Greeks happened in the middle of this time, in that span. Now, if you know history, I didn't know this, but he, you know, spent all this time campaigning to take over the Greeks because he wanted to avenge what his father was going to do. He spent so much time campaigning, so much time gathering resources, many years. And, you know, some of the historians say that the efforts that were undertaken to take on the Greeks was the most efforts taken in that time. There was just so much time surmounted to try to take over, and never had that much time been taken other than this. So, you know, you would think that this mighty king who is ruler of all these 127 provinces would, you know, have at least something up against the Greeks, but he failed. He did not win. The Greeks were able to conquer him. So you can only imagine this arrogant king is probably a little butthurt about that. Not having been able to conquer these Greeks after all this time. So that probably had a little something to do with, you know, him wishing for his queen to be back in his palace. Yes. And, you know, what better than a woman to comfort the man's wounds? after these things would probably entail all of that, you know, those years of him trying to conquer Greece and failing. So after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti. So he was wishing for his woman to be by his side. All the virgins that were in his harem were not enough. Vashti must have been something for him to have remembered her, even though he had other women to care for his pleasures. He must have loved her, you know, tremendously to have remembered her even after all those years. It's interesting that he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. It really seems like he's kind of placing all the spotlight on what she did as opposed to the decree he made against her. You know, he was the one who dethroned her. It's not like someone was twisting his... I mean, yes, he took the counsel of his people, but it's not like someone was necessarily forcing him to do that. He was the one who made the decree. He's the king. But he's kind of placing this emphasis on her. The wording there is really placing the emphasis on the fault of what she did and how, you know, her. Yes. Yes, yes. So he's, you know, he's sour and he's embarrassed. He's embarrassed by his loss and he remembers his queen. Let's see. You know, while he may be king of this whole empire, he is even prisoner to his own decree. This own decree that he made, he is still prisoner to that in terms of not being able to have his queen. Because remember, they said in the decree that she was not to come before him ever again. So he was not to see her ever again. So he couldn't even, because of his own decree, he couldn't even ask her back. So even the king was... They weren't supposed to go... Yeah, in the laws of the Medes and the Persians, you were not supposed to go back on their decree. So even his own decree, he was not supposed to. Yeah.
What?
Nothing that I found has ever said, you know, I mean, like, we'll see as it comes later in the story where he made a decree saying that all the Jews were to be executed. Then they had to make another decree in order to save them. He gave the Israelites the ability to fend for themselves, to fight against themselves, to save their life. So he didn't, you know, it's not like he took the decree back. He just gave them an out, basically. So they still had to enact that decree of going and trying to execute the Jews, but he gave another decree declaring that the Jews could fight back and defend themselves. So
it's almost like you tell a lie, but then you have to keep telling them.
I know. Yeah, I know. Yep. Yeah, so I don't know. I haven't seen any records showing that they went against any decrees. There hasn't been anything showing that, so I'm not sure what, because who would have enforced something? It really would have been probably the king, and he kind of can do, I guess, what he wants. But it seems like they really stuck to their decrees. But because you would think here, if he loved Vashti so much, why wouldn't he just go and say, well, forget the decree I made. Bring her back. Yeah, or make, yeah, I don't know. Who knows? But I suppose making a new decree, it could maybe make his authority look a little, washed out. Because, like, right, yeah, so.
Say the king legally unable to restore Vashti, so the counselors proposed a new plan with promise.
Mm-hmm. One of.
I'm sure his eyes lit up when they said.
I know. I know. You can just imagine. Right? Queen Vashti 2.0. One of the.
The most beautiful one out of the.
Right. Right, out of the whole province.
Yeah.
And one of the commentators, well, it was a sermon, he was saying, he's like, you know, you could just picture it was. It was like a frat party, and the frat boys were consoling their wounded friend and saying, oh, let's just go find you a woman. And he's like, yeah, great. That's pretty much the picture that we have here. All right, so verse 2, it says, then the king's young men who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. And then verse 3, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa in the capital under custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them. So the council says, bring on the women.
And
yes, it does. Yep, and it's an interchangeable. Mm-hmm. It can even, yeah, it's interchangeable. Appointed officers, young men, it's kind of his posse. Right? Shucker. So it's just his closest confidants who would have given him the counsel, just like back in chapter 1 where they were giving him his, those were the eunuchs who gave him his legal counsel here also. I don't know for certain that they are the exact same people as in chapter 1, but it's possible just because it seems like he's got this crowd who is his closest companions who give him counsel. And I think he needs to find new people to give him counsel and wisdom because. So obviously new women, new beautiful women are going to solve all of his problems, right? They're going to solve all of King Xerxes' problems. That's what he thinks. So this word for virgins here, it says beautiful young virgins. That word is betula in Hebrew. It would have intended to mean a woman or a young woman of marriageable age. And that, even in the Persian culture, as pagan as they were, that still would have intended to mean a virgin. Even back then, they would consider you you should have been a virgin until marriage. You were not supposed to consummate anything before marriage. So they would assume young virgin to mean a girl of marriageable age who had not had intercourse yet. Nothing stated specifically, but just based generally around what we know of even Hebrew, it was young, you know, teenage years. Mm-hmm. Yep, 12, 13. Mm-hmm.
We are beautiful then.
Right. 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 No. Yep. Yep. So young. I mean, a teenager.
Wow, 13 years old.
Probably. Yep. Because, you know, Mary, we knew that she was probably 13. Yeah. 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Right. 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 Yep. It was normal. That was the norm. Mm-hmm. So, but it's so hard. I'm pretty positive that King Xerxes would have been in his like late 30s, maybe early 40s at this time. So it's hard to picture that, you know, in our mind. That just, yes, all I can picture of this whole thing, the harem, the king, all I can see is like a brothel, a sex brothel that they are just, it's, yeah. So it's very, very hard to picture that, but it was the culture, but the Israelites are to be separate. They're supposed to be distinct from the rest of the culture. And so, yes, that was the pagan culture at that time, but an Israelite should not be with an uncircumcised man, you know, and that would have been King Xerxes. And so Esther is going to be with a man who is uncircumcised, who is in the pagan world, and that wasn't right. Right. Which is this tension that we have to hold. And every time I read on, I'm just like, oh, Lord, why? Why? But again, he knows better than I do. We'll kind of get to that in these next few verses. There's a little bit of debate about that over in some of the commentaries. Some commentators say that some of the verbiage that we'll see in here, it says that Esther was taken. So some commentators feel like that passiveness could indicate that she went unwillingly. Other commentators seem to think that there's no definitive verbiage that would say that she fought to leave or Mordecai. Right. Whereas like in Dan, like I said, we'll see later on. There's nothing of Mordecai like trying to stop her. Nothing. We don't see anything. And it seems to kind of contrast with Daniel, where Daniel did go before the king and say, I don't want to, would you let me eat of the diet that my Lord gave of me? And so the commentators kind of seem to wrestle with this idea that they just kind of allowed the pagan culture to assimilate them. And I don't know. From what I read, I seem to think that the verbiage tends to go towards more of they just allowed them to come and take her. Because there's really no indication.
Army coming at you. You know, we want that girl. Mm-hmm. Not much really anybody can do about it.
Yeah.
Right, but if it's known that the king is gathering the most beautiful virgins and you don't want your daughter or niece taken, then you would, I mean, it's
go to an extent.
Think to try to hide,
like, right, like right, like we saw with Moses, with you know his mother knew that Pharaoh was going to come and execute all the babies, and so she went and hid him, and the text gives that. So, my personal opinion is just there doesn't seem to be much here in the text that suggests that they tried to fight against assimilation. They seem to just go along with it.
And from their point of view, you know, Esther, even if she's not chosen as king, queen, mm-hmm. would still be provided for,
right.
taken care of. She's an orphan.
Right, right.
And
yep.
so maybe
she would have been in the harem.
Thinks, well, you know, she'll be taken care of in the palace. And mm-hmm. even if she's not chosen queen, mm-hmm. she'll still be part of the harem and
right.
have food and,
right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Sure. Yep. Right. 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 And it is likely that they had a little bit of time heading out, because probably what would have happened, like with every other decree, they would have sent it out on the royal road. And then maybe after that came and the officers came to take the women, you know, because it says that in verse 3, and let the king appoint officers in all provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful women. So it sounds like there was an officer in each province. And remember, we said 127 provinces, or that could be people groups. So there was an officer in each of those people groups that maybe was appointed to go and seek out in their people group or their area or the most beautiful, gather them, and then take them to the harem. So, yeah. So there could have been a little bit of time they would have known. All right. So back in verse 2, did we finish that? Yeah, we got that. Okay, so, yeah, verse 3, the commission of the young women from every province went. This actually went against the custom of that time, because here the decree is saying, go and find women of all the different provinces, all those different people groups. The custom of that time was the king was supposed to marry a woman from one of the seven royal families. So the fact that they even counseled him to go and find someone from Joe Blow down the road, that was against the custom of that time. So I'm like, man, dude, you really need to find some different counselors, because they're not giving you the greatest advice here. But yeah, at that time, they were supposed to marry from one of the seven royal families. There was only seven Persian royal families, and that was where Vashti had come from, and so they should have counseled him to find from there. But instead, now again, we can see this as God's providence, right? Because it would have, based on custom, it would have been from one of the seven families. But in God's providence, the counselors give the advice to find from one of the provinces.
Did these young guys know
them? The council?
Yeah.
I would assume so, because back in chapter 1, where it talks about those, that council who is closest to him, the Hebrew terminology literally would have been legal counsel. So you would assume that their legal counsel just kind of does what they want. You know, and some were saying that maybe they felt bad for the king, that he was so embarrassed after losing this war, and they just wanted to kind of appease him, because again, we see that the king is hot-headed and tempered, and they don't want him angry, you know, so they're going to do anything to keep him satisfied. And so maybe they just thought, well, this will give him the pick of the entire empire, and then he'll get to choose what his liking is. So I don't, yeah.
My thought was maybe they were so young.
Sure.
They didn't really know all the previous decrees.
Yeah. It seems that these were the council, these would have been the men who would give him his legal advice and legal counsel. So they should have known, they would know what that council was to be, or what the decrees and what the laws at that time were, what the customs were at that time. It seems. Because he was handed an entire kingdom. King Xerxes didn't work a day in his life, I'm sure. He grew up in a royal family, so it's very unlikely he had to work a day in his life. And then when his father passed away, he was handed the entire known world at the age of, you know, in his 30s. And so he really probably was handed everything that he wanted during his life. So yeah, it's not surprising that he was a grown toddler.
When parents give in to the toddler's demand, mm-hmm. they run everything. Mm-hmm. You can't discipline with them.
Right. So see, Ainsley, your mommy loves you when she's disciplining you.
No, I have more problems with your father.
It's a great and wonderful thing to have a mom who will enact it. Yes. That's how you know they love you. All right. So, okay, verse 4. And let the young women who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This pleased the king, and he did so. As Mesha said, shocker. Xerxes obviously had a great appreciation for beautiful things. We saw that in the palace. He had a beautiful, ornate palace that we saw in the video, how ornately it was decorated. they spared no expense in decorating the palace. They went to great lengths and a beautiful, beautiful gardens, as we saw in chapter one. Gold couches, gold vessels, you know, mother of pearl on the floor, beautiful purple curtains hung. So obviously the kings at that time had high taste in beautiful things, and that there's no exception when it comes to his women. He also has high taste when it comes to his women. It's pretty evident that the kings in this empire had no regard for the people of their empire, and at will would pluck them out of their homes and bring them into their palace in however they choose. And so, you know, they, based on their own desire, they would just uproot you from your home and take you. Now, in that time, it's very possible that the women of that empire, they might have longed to be plucked up and taken to the palace, maybe. You know, I don't know, depending on where your perspective comes from. Because if you're just kind of living in, you know, the peasant land, then you probably desired to get plucked up and taken into the palace. Right. You would be given everything you could possibly need and more. And you were in the royal harem. I mean, the entire world looks at royalty in Britain even here. And so I'm sure even at that time, it was similar. But for the Jewish diaspora at the time, they should be living set apart. And so as desirable as maybe it looks, their life should be set apart from what the pagan culture was at that time. All right. The original reason for Vashti's disposal in chapter 1 was to replace her with someone more worthy. So in verse 19 of chapter 1, it says, if it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before the king Ahasuerus, or King Xerxes, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So at that time, when the decree went out, it seems that the only requirement was just to find someone more worthy, someone more compliant than who Vashti was. But now we see here in chapter 2, it seems like the criteria has changed a little bit. We're not looking just for someone more compliant. We're looking for the most beautiful, the most gorgeous, the most desirable in form, not just someone more compliant. And I find it really ironic that they're looking for the most beautiful when at first they were supposed to be looking for someone more compliant or someone better. And yet who comes onto the scene? And she maybe is, Esther is a sweet talker in the sense of she sugarcoats what she says, but was she compliant in the end? No, she went up against what Xerxes' decree was. She had to go before the king when she was not called, and that could have resulted in her death. But she chose to, maybe in a different way, in a different light than when Vashti did. Vashti just said no. You know, Queen Esther was a little more sweet. Yes, she sweet-talked him a little more than what Vashti did. But it is ironic to me that they were looking for someone a little more compliant, and even Esther, who they replaced her with, who met the beautiful requirements, was also not quite as compliant as what they were hoping.
Well, they started out with, well, let's get someone more obedient.
Mm-hmm.
They still went to their simple.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Okay, so like we were, Joyce was asking earlier, was it by choice, or, you know, was this more so by force? Like I said, a lot of commentators seem to think that this was not just an average beauty competition where you chose to enter yourself into the competition. It seems that by living in the empire, you were automatically thrown into the lot, because it says the council gave in every single province of the entire empire, there was to be officials who would go into their province and find the beautiful women and gather them and bring them to the palace. So it seems that it wasn't by choice. It was, you got picked. So can you imagine this officer coming probably into your home and lining up all the daughters and picking the most beautiful and taking her out. You know, I can just picture Cinderella and the evil stepsisters just loathing watching Cinderella walk by and how they maybe watched them leave and were jealous that they were picked over, you know, the beautiful ones were picked over them and taken to the harem. But it seems that, you know, they just came and took them and took, you didn't really have a choice in the matter. Really, truly, resistance to the empire is futile because you're going to be assimilated. The king rules his empire and his way goes. He does what he wants and he will pluck you up regardless of what your plans were. The empire doesn't care for what your plans for your life were. You may have had an entire livelihood planned out. You had an established people. You had friends there. You had your family there, but it didn't matter because the officials came and the empire didn't care for what your roots were in your hometown. One of the commentators said, "My body, my choice would not have translated well in Persia." Nope, it wouldn't have. Persian history makes no indication that these women would be allowed to return home once brought to the harem. So it seemed that it was a perpetual widowhood, really, that you were being given to, because you would be brought to the harem, but you were placed in the harem was the palace for the women, and you were only brought out whenever the king decided he wanted to have his way with you. And so it seems from the tradition of Persia at that time that they were never allowed to go back to their home. You know, they just lived out their days in the palace. Which, just Persian history seems to record that, yep, okay. That they were not allowed to go back. They were added, oh, go ahead.
My commentary is saying, like, once they left their first harem, it was like the walk of shame to the next harem as they went to the concubine.
Sure, yep, harem. Where this, yep.
And then that was going to be their life.
Right, right. Right, right. Nothing that I see, it just says that everything that I read said that Persian history they made no indication to say that they allowed them out of the harem. So it kind of seems to imply that maybe until old age or until they died, really. Because there's no, yeah.
Well, they're now no longer virgins, so
right.
They've been the king, so no one else is going to take them after that.
Mm-hmm. Woman. I know. Which, I mean, he probably didn't have anything to do with them because many commentators said, just in Persian history, there was women who saw the king once in their lifetime. One time. And
it ruined their life.
Right. And they, but then they were, yeah, their life was ruined because, yeah, like Maisha said, they were no longer a virgin. So now, even if they were to be allowed to go back into the community, no man's going to want that because they've already been ruined.
So.
We would assume, yeah, yeah, right, right, yep, yep. That's very safe to assume.
Talked more in detail about how their society actually kept going because, I mean, if he sucked up all the virgins,
right, just the most beautiful, yes.
So the,
right, yes. Which you would think would eventually hurt him because then they just keep having ugly babies. And then eventually they run out. But I don't know. No, I'm just kidding. I know, I know. It's true. Every child is beautiful and made in the image of God. So, yeah, he just kept adding to his collection of live play dolls, really. And would maybe take them out once in their lifetime, unless it pleased the king. And then, like Queen Vashti, would become queen. again, a lot of history indicated that few in the empire would have resisted this because of the extravagance of the palace and getting to really be taken care of then. They probably wouldn't have resisted it. They would have been glad to go.
Because they've assimilated, because their ancestors chose not to leave, so they're living in sin.
Well, and now remember here, those who are being brought here are not necessarily all Israelites. There could have been some, you know, but a lot of them would have been actually of Persian culture, so they would have been pagan to start off. So I don't know beyond Esther if there were other Israelites who were taken.
I was just thinking that because she hides
her. Right, right.
Faith.
Yeah.
Because Mordecai tells her, so I was just
right.
I was thinking
sure.
If there were any other Israelites.
Sure.
They would be too scared.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, yeah, a majority of these would have been pagan women. It doesn't tell us who beyond Esther could have possibly been an Israelite or not. So even more reason why they would have been happy to go, because that was their life. They would have been lavished in beauty care and a gorgeous palace, desirable delicacies to be eaten. But they would be devoting themselves truly to perpetual widowhood because, and most would only see the king for one night. All right, so now on to verse 5. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. So we see here in the beginning, Susa, the citadel, remember in the introduction where I said that there's this distinction between the citadel and the city of Susa. The citadel is the same as the fortress or the palace. So that term, whenever you see the citadel or the fortress, that's just, they're talking about the palace. So it seems that Mordecai lived in and around the palace area. It doesn't necessarily imply that he was living inside the palace, but within that area of the palace he lived. So he didn't live far away, which also means Esther came from right near where the palace was. She wasn't from one of the other, you know, provinces from the area. So they were from just that area. They would have been close. Mordecai, that is his Babylonian name. Not his Hebrew name, that's his Babylonian name. It's a transliteration for Marduka. Marduka was a Babylonian god, and so Mordecai is derived from Marduka. There is a palace inscription that was found by excavators who lists Marduka as one of Xerxes' officials. So this just emphasizes, because we'll see in the end of Esther that Mordecai was raised to second in command to King Xerxes. And there has been found inscriptions that have Marduka on there. So that supports what we see here in Esther.
I'm sorry, what does Marduka mean?
No, that's okay. Marduka was, it was just a, I didn't find the meaning, but it was a Babylonian god. Mm-hmm. One of Babylon's gods was Marduka. All right, so then we see that there's a little genealogy given. Mordecai was a descendant of Kish, who was a Benjamite. Now, Kish had a son. We know from back in later, or text prior to Esther, that Kish had a son. Does anybody know who Kish was or who his son was? Yes, Saul. So let's read in 1 Samuel 9:1. Terry, I'm always amazed at your ability to recall those facts. I know, you always say that. Your memory's not good, and yet you remember. Well, Well, obviously you've prioritized what you remember because you remember all the biblical things. All right. 1 Samuel 9:1, if someone could read that.
Aphia.
Son of a Benjamite. Man of wealth. And then verse 2 also, sorry.
He had a son named Saul, an impressive young man. There was no one more impressive among all the Israelites than he.
Yes.
He stood a head taller than anyone else.
Yep, so he had a son named Saul. So this is our connection with back to the Benjamites. So Mordecai is listed as a Benjamite because Saul was a son of Kish, who was a Benjamite, right? Now, there is some discrepancy on verse 6. Does anybody's version say in the beginning of verse 6, he had been... Marian, read for me verse 6. So... a lot of your versions might say he had been, you have who? Yeah, mine says who as well. But that can also say he. Most versions say he. So there's some discrepancy on who the he is. When you read it quickly, it seems that he in verse 6 is referring to Mordecai. But the issue with that is if that he is referring to Mordecai, that would make him, because it says who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives carried away with Jeconiah. Well, that would make Mordecai 120 years old if the he is referring to that person who was carried away with Jeconiah. And it's very unlikely that Mordecai is 120 years old because, for one, he took on Esther as his daughter to take care of her. And in all of the texts of Esther, he seems very, very capable. He's in the city, you know, at the city gate waiting and watching. He ends up, you know, so that would be way on the older end spectrum of things, because back in, I remember when we did Exodus, and I think we said that even in the Egyptian time, 120 was of an older age, right? That was, you were on the older side of things. So it's, most commentators say that it's very unlikely that he is referring to Mordecai, but instead it's referring to Kish as the he who was carried away. Not the same Kish as the father of Saul. It would have been a different Kish, because the father of Saul would have been 500 years ago. So it wouldn't have been that same Kish, but a Kish in the line of the Benjamites. Does that make sense?
Okay, so you're saying that this Mordecai, the descendant of Kish, is not necessarily the same Kish as father.
Right. No, it just would have been someone in the same line. Probably just another, someone else named Kish. Yes. Right.
I'm just going to draw he, Benjamin.
Sorry, I know. It is a little bit. Do you want me to try to re-explain it, or you think? Just because, let's say there is a Kish who had Saul, who was the Benjamite. So there's the Benjamite line, right, that kind of starts back there. Kish was a Benjamite. He had Saul, who was a son. But then we continue down that line of genealogy, and there could have been another Kish who was, you know, it's very common to name your descendants. Right.
Theoretically, been through Kish's line through another son.
Right. The main connection is just that they're coming from the Benjamite clan, if that makes sense.
Could have been, you know, Benjamin was several hundred years removed from Stephen.
Sure.
Uncle Kish.
Sure.
Cousin Kish.
Sure. Yeah. Right.
Kish.
Right. Yep, this is a Kish, yeah, much. So the Kish in this verse that we're reading is just further down the line. The only reason we went back to 1 Samuel was to make the connection of Saul being a Benjamite. And we talked about in past Bible studies that there was that tension between Saul as a Benjamite and the Amalekites that happened. And we'll see why, you know, as we enter into the story, why that's important. But it's just to kind of draw you back to where this, the Benjamite line goes. So the Kish we have here in verse 5, it's not the same Kish that we just read in 1 Samuel, but we're kind of getting further down the line in here. So this Kish here was carried away with Jeconiah into exile when Nebuchadnezzar. So that would have been 120 years ago. So that's why we think that he, referring in verse 6, is referring to Kish as opposed to Mordecai. The text is a little funny the way that the sentence is structured. But again, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense that Mordecai would be 120 years old, because that would have been old age at that time. And he...
Well, even possibly greater than 120, if taken into exile, mm-hmm. 120.
Sure.
So
mm-hmm. Sure.
Of some age.
Sure. Right. Even, yeah, he could, I suppose he could have been a baby. They did, but remember... Oh, yeah. Not Moses, yeah. Or Noah. Noah was
Noah.
Yeah. Moses, does it say how long Moses lived? I forget if it said. Moses was 120? Okay.
40, 40, and 40.
That's right. Yep, that's right. They did, but then after the flood, it seems that the number went down. Yeah, of how long they lived. And I remember Mesha saying from Egyptian record, 100 Egyptian record was an average was 120 years old. That was the longest that they lived. That was even old for them. So more than likely now we're many, many hundreds of years out from that Egyptian period. And it's likely that that's similar, you know,
I
that.
Think it's more like 80 by now.
Sure.
David makes in some of the Psalms, makes some 70 or 80.
Sure.
If 70 years, if by something or other strength, maybe. 80.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yep. See, you have a great memory. Yeah, right. They are. Yep. Right. But based on what we see in the rest of the story, Mordecai seems very agile, very capable. He's able to go and be at the gate. He's able to care for Esther. You know, so if you were in that old of an age, it's unlikely that he was so capable. So, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yep. Right. And that's why in that verse 6 that he is who they think they're referring to Kish. Mm-hmm. Yep. Any other questions about that? Is it as clear as mud, as one of my friend's moms always said? All right. Let's see. Where am I? Okay. Mm-hmm. Does it make a little more sense?
Yeah.
A little?
It says, Mordecai's genealogy is problematic if attempting to link him to this Kish, father of King Saul.
Right.
Kish could have hardly been Mordecai's great-grandfather, so the time gap between the two is over 500.
Right. That Kish would have been hard to, yeah.
But we also have to remember, too, in Bible genealogy, when it says son of, it doesn't necessarily mean literally son.
Right.
Of.
Right.
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 I'm not saying that that's the case here.
Yep.
I'm just saying that is
possible. Right. And it's very common that they would name someone the same down the road.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Right. You have the second and first. Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. Because I think Artaxerxes then had another Darius that he named. Artaxerxes named his son Darius. And there was already a King Darius who was before. Right. All right. Verse 7. What do we have for time? Okay. I don't think we're going to make it through chapter 2. No, it's fine. I'm glad we're talking. It helped. I think it helps all of us sink into our brain when we talk about it and we mull it over and over and put it in your own words, that helps it solidify in your own mind what's going on. All right, so verse 7. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So Esther is introduced in a dependent relationship to Mordecai. We see that Mordecai had to care for her because she was an orphan. She was a young girl, probably. He didn't have to. Yes, right. He didn't have to, but he chose. Yes. Yep. He would actually, well, technically though, he's actually a cousin, because it says, where is it? The daughter of his uncle. Right. So his uncle's daughter. So really that would make him her cousin, but a lot. Right. Yep. Yep. Verse 15. Yep. Yep. And so I think a lot of times when people read this quickly, because I've even seen it written in not necessarily commentaries, but sermon notes, where they say her uncle, but really it's not. It's her cousin who maybe could have been old enough to be an uncle, you know, but it was, they were cousins. That is her Hebrew name. Yes. Esther is her Babylonian name. Yep. So let's see where it says that he took her for his own daughter. I think that's at the end of the verse, right? Yeah. At the end of 7, where it says he took her as his own daughter. That is the same kind of terminology in Hebrew for adoption. Now,
adopted.
Oh, your actual verse says adopted. You mean, okay, yep. Now, in Old Testament law, there is no legal terminology for adoption. They didn't have in that Old Testament. There is terms that would relate back to, you know, adoption or you taking on a child as your own, but there wasn't any legal terminology in Hebrew law for that. Now in Persian law, there was legal adoption processes. And so what likely has happened is they've assimilated to the culture. And so they've taken on the practices of the Persian empire, which had legal adoption action. They would have taken actual formal legal action in adoption. So it's very possible that, you know, Mordecai was taking on the Persian culture's legal action of adopting her. But that's where in the Hebrew text, that's this he took her, they kind of had to create their own wording for that, because there's no true Old Testament, you know, Hebrew language for that. We see the adoption commonly in the Nuzi text. Nuzi is an ancient document that's found in the ancient, there's documents found in ancient cities in Mesopotamia, that state some of this legal talk about adoption. While we don't see formal Old Testament adoption, we do see God hinting at his taking of his children, you know, as his own. We can see that in Exodus, or let's go to Psalm 2, 7 through 8. Psalm 2, 7 through 8. Someone can read that when you get there. Mm-hmm. So there, you know, he's obviously talking about Israel. He's taking them as his son. So it hints at the idea of adoption, but there's no actual terminology in the Hebrew for adoption. But, you know, we know from Bible text that adoption is such a huge piece of our ability as Gentiles to be in God's family, that he has allowed for us to be adopted into his family. So that is a huge, huge part of our life in the Lord. Okay. So back in Esther. So Esther's name. It seems interesting that the author specially notes her Jewish name first. Because Mordecai, we aren't given his Hebrew name. We're only given his Babylonian name. And so it's interesting that they note that first, and the commentators seem to think that maybe that attributes to her identifying herself in her Jewishness first, as opposed to the pagan culture that they were living in. Hadassah. It should be, is it listed there in verse 7 for you? It should be there, Hadassah, Hadassah. He was bringing up Hadassah. It attributes, yeah, that she would identify, they think that maybe the author wrote this to attribute her identity in her Jewishness first, as opposed to her assimilation to Babylon. Now, that's just speculation, because it does seem that there's some distinction between Mordecai, because Mordecai is not given, we don't have his Hebrew name given here, only his Babylonian name. So it's just interesting. And then even when you go back to Daniel, they make a distinction between his Babylonian name and his Jewish name. And so they think maybe that can attribute that she would identify with her Jewish heritage first. Esther, let's see, where am I? Hadassah means myrtle. Myrtle was a type of tree that was common in that time. And then Esther is the transliteration of the Persian name, you know, that they had at that time in Hebrew. So Esther is her Babylonian name, but it's transliteration of it into Hebrew. Ishtar. Mm-hmm. Yep. Derived from a common Babylonian goddess, Ishtar, which derived from that name is the meaning star. They believe that meant star. Mm-hmm. Yes, Esther was derived from the goddess Ishtar, which then is derived from, or means star. Hadassah means myrtle, which is a tree.
Oh, I thought you said that Esther was sort of that in Hebrew.
So, Hadassah means myrtle. Hadassah is the Hebrew name for her.
Right.
But then Esther would have been the transliteration in Hebrew of the Persian name for Esther. Does that make sense? Nope. The Babylonian name. I know. It's confusing because you're taking a Persian word and then you're translating it into Hebrew and then now translating it into English. So it's like, yeah. All right. So Esther, from the beginning, is described as one with a beautiful figure. Extremely beautiful. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. So this emphasis, it's a double emphasis, right? It didn't just say she was beautiful. It said she had a lovely figure and was beautiful to look at. Or was lovely to look at. So she's right away described as someone of beauty. Now, again, I think that this is God's providence, that beauty is a gift from the Lord. And again, in God's providence and his sovereignty, he made her beautiful because the king would find favor with her, right? So from the beginning of the moment she was born, he created her to be beautiful, so that now, for such a time as this, in the story of Esther, she would be chosen as queen. Who would have thought that a little orphan girl would be used in such... I, like, have chills saying that because, you know, so many of Sam's cousins and many people in our family have fostered and adopted children, and they are the forgotten of the world because their parents either have given up on them or have passed away, and nobody expects, you know, this little orphan girl, a Jewish orphan girl of all in a pagan culture, to have any impact in terms of the kingdom, or even maybe it would be likely even for a Jew to even think, how could you, what impact are you going to have on the kingdom, even, because you're this little orphan girl. And much less in the eyes of the pagan world because of her Jewish heritage. Why would they think of her as anything? So it's just amazing to see that God does not forget his children. Yeah.
Because she's Jewish, which doesn't like the Jews. She's an orphan and she's a girl.
Yes.
Yep. Strikes you out.
Yes. The lowest of the low. And I mean, haven't we seen that over going through Genesis and Exodus? We have seen that over and over again. He uses the unlikely, the least of these. I mean, it's just amazing to see that God does not forget his people, and it's so easy for us to feel in the turmoil of our life or the events that are happening in our life to feel like God has forgotten about me. The events of my life, the circumstances of my life, it is so easy to think in our sinfulness that God has forgotten. But he hasn't. If he can name and know and not misplace a single one of the stars. I don't know how many stars there are. I'm sure billions. But he knows every one of them by name. And how much more does he know us, his children? How much more? And Queen Esther was no exception to that. He did not forget her. He had a mighty purpose for her life, just as he does for each one of ours. It may not look the same as what Esther's did, but truly we need to live our lives in a way that says God has not forgotten me. He has a mighty purpose for me in terms of the kingdom. And if we live our lives in that way, I think so, you know, we have to, our thoughts that can easily enslave us in thinking that I'm nothing, you know, who's really going to know if I sin, or who's really going to know if I even do a good deed? You know, what really does it matter? It can be so easy sometimes to get in that thinking that I'm just this small little person in terms of the whole world or the whole universe. But yet God views us as important and such a vital part of him furthering his plan and his kingdom and bringing the glory back to him. And so we get to live our lives in such an amazing way to say, wow, Lord, you have not forgotten me. You are not far off from me. You are right there next to me. And you are making your plan happen through me. And that is so humbling that he is choosing to use us. Very humbling. Okay, I'm wondering if we should, I guess we've got five more. I think we can do another verse. All right, verse 8. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa the citadel in custody of Hegai, the Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in the custody of Hegai, who had charge of the women. So remember, this is the guy who... he's in charge of all the women, right? Now, where it says when the king's orders and his edicts were proclaimed, and the many young women were gathered in the Susa, Esther also was taken into the king's palace. It, like I said before, there was some debate about whether she went willingly or whether she was forcibly taken. And You can kind of, you know, if you want to come to a conclusion yourself based off the text, but I would lean more on the edge of, based on the fact that she seems to make no qualms about what they feed her and what how they dressed her and, you know, all those things. She doesn't put up a fight at all. It seems that she was just willing to be taken. And what?
Maybe God told her in a dream or something that he was going to
Yeah, it could be, but it also seems odd that he would tell her, I'm going to go and choose to live and have intercourse with a pagan culture when God specifically told them to stay away from them, to not. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, could you imagine having an official? Right.
They're like Stockholm Syndrome. Mm-hmm. They do what they're told.
Yep.
That's it.
Right. Right.
Right.
It could be fear. It could. Right. It could be fear. It could be even that it was desirable to think to go and live there because of the luxury of the palace. So, you know, we don't know what Esther's intentions, you know, or what her thinking was. It's hard because the text doesn't give us a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, the king is commanding, right.
When who should their authority have been? Should be God, no matter what the consequences are. You know, it should. Right, and that's their ancestors did put them in a position of exactly this, because if their ancestors had gone back to the Judah, then Esther wouldn't really be in this position of having to make this choice, which then again takes us back to obeying God matters all the time. 100% we should be obeying and pursuing righteousness, because we think, who's really gonna know? You know, what does it really matter if I obey or not? But the consequences are generations and generations passing, because it started with Eve. And now thousands of years later, here we are.
But as an individual, we do not know what, how much, or what she was taught to even have a sense. I mean, I would imagine that she was at least taught, you're a Jew, we believed in one God, you know, like super basic.
Sure.
But beyond that, you know, your life should be completely different than the culture.
Sure.
That she really got.
Right. They were supposed to pass it on, but you're right. We don't know.
How many of them were actually faithful at passing on? You get lots of examples of very bad parents in the Old Testament.
Right. So. Yep. Nope. That's very true. It's very true. And, I mean, she was young, and she was under the authority of Mordecai at the time. So really, it kind of was also in Mordecai's hands to put up a fight against it, you know? And it doesn't seem to indicate anywhere that he did, which I can only imagine if this was Sam and his daughter, Olivia. Now, I know Esther's not truly her daughter, but he adopted her as his daughter. And
You probably have that same kind of love and feeling.
Right. He seemed to care for her because he, you know, went to the gate to see how she was doing, but
even Mordecai, how much did he really
right.
The law?
He seems to
the
be pretty assimilated.
They didn't have Bibles they could read
Right.
I mean, maybe he did, but maybe he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And even if he loved Esther, he may have thought, well, this is a good opportunity for her in terms of now you don't have to be poor the rest of your life, or I don't know.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's very, because now, I mean, they've assimilated to the culture. Right. They've assimilated to the pagan culture. And that's why it is so important for us to stand against the culture at all costs. At all costs. Because then it continues on for generations that, you know, if we do not pass on truth of the word, how is the generation to follow us going to know? You know, and the same for them here. And so, in a sense, there's this half of me that kind of wants to be like, seriously, Mordecai? Like, really? But at the same time, yes, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right that they've been assimilated. And, you know, as the generations have gone on, they assimilated themselves to the culture around them. And it's very unfortunate. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep, for sure.
At least we have the word of God. Any individual can go and find out the truth for themselves.
Yes.
They did not all have copies.
That's true.
Of the law of Moses.
And we don't know if they could all read at that time.
That's
either.
Right.
They didn't have it, but at the same time, that didn't really exempt them from, right? I mean, we would say that whether... They
exempt them from, I think, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind.
Mm-hmm.
The delineations of the specific application mm-hmm. of that in terms of laws and lifestyle practices and this and that may have been unknown to some generations.
Yeah, it is possible. I think it's just when this text has been is here in the canon and they are an Israelite and we know all that the Israelites have been taught over the years specifically by the Lord and they were supposed to be, I think we have to maybe not give excuses even for Esther and Mordecai, even if they didn't know all of the specifics because the Israelites were supposed to be set apart. And I know, in fairness, we want to give them the benefit of the doubt, right? We want to give them like, oh, well, they didn't know, so they were, you know. But throughout all of the text of the Bible, God said you were to be set apart no matter what.
Well, and the only reason they're there is because God's punishing them.
They, mm-hmm. were sent into exile. They were told even.
Babylon.
Right.
That's the only reason
right.
the Jews are even there.
Right.
And then, like we said before, their ancestors mm-hmm. should have returned mm-hmm. to the land.
Right. Yep. All right. I should probably wrap us up here since we're past a little bit. But thank you, ladies. We got through half of chapter. I think I had a little more for verse 8, but it's okay. We'll do it next week.